She told him about the motor and the place where she had found it. She told him that it had proved impossible to learn the name of the inventor. She did not mention the details of her quest. She handed him photographs of the motor and the remnant of the manuscript. She watched him as he read. She saw the professional assurance in the swift, scanning motion of his eyes, at first, then the pause, then the growing intentness, then a movement of his lips which from another man would have been a whistle or a gasp. She saw him stop for long minutes and look off as if his mind were racing over countless sudden trails, trying to follow them all. She saw him leaf back through the pages, then stop, then force himself to read on as if he were torn between his eagerness to continue and his eagerness to seize all the possibilities breaking open before his vision. She saw his silent excitement. She knew that he had forgotten her office, her existence, everything, but the sight of an achievement. And in tribute to his being capable of such reaction, she wished it were possible for her to like Dr. Robert Stadler. They had been silent for over an hour when he finished and looked up at her. "But this is extraordinary," he said in the joyous, astonished tone of announcing some news she had not expected. She wished she could smile in answer and grant him the comradeship of a joy celebrated together. But she merely nodded and said coldly, "Yes."
"But, Miss Taggart, this is tremendous."
"Yes."
"Did you say it's a matter of technology? It's more, much, much more than that. The pages where he writes about his converter, you can see what premise he's speaking from. He arrived at some new concept of energy. He discarded all our standard assumptions according to which his motor would have been impossible. He formulated a new premise of his own, and he solved the secret of converting static energy into kinetic power. Do you know what that means? Do you realize what a feat of pure, abstract science he had to perform before he could make his motor?"
"Who?" she asked quietly.
"I beg your pardon?"
"That was the first of the two questions I wanted to ask you, Dr. Stadler. Can you think of any young scientist you might have known 10 years ago who would have been able to do this?"
He paused, astonished. He had not had time to wonder about that question.
"No," he said slowly, frowning. "No, I can't think of anyone. And that's odd, because an ability of this kind couldn't have passed unnoticed anywhere. Somebody would have called him to my attention. They always sent promising young physicists to me. Did you say you found this in the research laboratory of a plain commercial motor factory?"
"Yes."
"That's odd. What was he doing in such a place?"
"Designing a motor."
"That's what I mean. A man with the genius of a great scientist who chose to be a commercial inventor? I find it outrageous. He wanted a motor, and he quietly performed a major revolution in the science of energy just as a means to an end. And he didn't bother to publish his findings, but went right on making his motor. Why did he want to waste his mind on practical appliances?"
"Perhaps because he liked living on this earth," she said involuntarily.
"I beg your pardon?"
"No, I'm sorry, Dr. Stadler. I did not intend to discuss any irrelevant subject."
He was looking off, pursuing his own course of thought. "Why didn't he come to me? Why wasn't he in some great scientific establishment where he belonged? If he had the brains to achieve this, surely he had the brains to know the importance of what he had done. Why didn't he publish a paper on his definition of energy? I can see the general direction he'd taken, but God damn him, the most important pages are missing. The statement isn't here. Surely somebody around him should have known enough to announce his work to the whole world of science. Why didn't they? How could they abandon, just abandon, a thing of this kind?"
"These are the questions to which I found no answers."
"And besides, from the purely practical aspect, why was that motor left in a junk pile? You think any greedy fool of an industrialist would have grabbed it in order to make a fortune? No intelligence was needed to see its commercial value."
She smiled for the first time, a smile ugly with bitterness. She said nothing.
"You found it impossible to trace the inventor?" he asked.
"Completely impossible, so far."
"Do you think that he is still alive?"
"I have reason to think that he is, but I can't be sure."
"Suppose I tried to advertise for him?"
"No, don't."
"But if I were to place ads in scientific publications, and have Dr. Ferris—"
He stopped. He saw her glance at him as swiftly as he glanced at her. She said nothing, but she held his glance.
He looked away and finished the sentence, coldly and firmly. "And have Dr. Ferris broadcast on the radio that I wish to see him. Would he refuse to come?"
"Yes, Dr. Stadler, I think he would refuse."
He was not looking at her. She saw the faint tightening of his facial muscles, and simultaneously, the look of something going slack in the lines of his face. She could not tell what sort of light was dying within him, nor what made her think of the death of a light. He tossed the manuscript down on the desk with a casual, contemptuous movement of his wrist. "Those men who do not mind being practical enough to sell their brains for money ought to acquire a little knowledge of the conditions of practical reality." He looked at her with a touch of defiance, as if waiting for an angry answer. But her answer was worse than anger. Her face remained expressionless, as if the truth or falsehood of his convictions were of no concern to her any longer. She said politely, "The second question I wanted to ask you was whether you would be kind enough to tell me the name of any physicist you know who, in your judgment, would possess the ability to attempt the reconstruction of this motor." He looked at her and chuckled. It was a sound of pain. "Have you been tortured by it too, Miss Taggart? By the impossibility of finding any sort of intelligence anywhere? I have interviewed some physicists who were highly recommended to me, and I have found them to be hopeless." He leaned forward eagerly. "Miss Taggart," he asked, "did you call on me because you trusted the integrity of my scientific judgment?" The question was a naked plea. "Yes," she answered evenly. "I trusted the integrity of your scientific judgment." He leaned back. He looked as if some hidden smile were smoothing the tension away from his face. "I wish I could help you," he said, as to a comrade. "I most selfishly wish I could help you, because, you see, this has been my hardest problem, trying to find men of talent for my own staff. Talent, hell, I'd be satisfied with just a semblance of promise, but the men they send me couldn't be honestly said to possess the potentiality of developing into decent garage mechanics. I don't know whether I'm getting older and more demanding, or whether the human race is degenerating, but the world didn't seem to be so barren of intelligence in my youth. Today, if you saw the kind of men I've had to interview, you'd—" He stopped abruptly, as if at a sudden recollection. He remained silent. He seemed to be considering something he knew, but did not wish to tell her. She became certain of it when he concluded brusquely, in that tone of resentment which conceals an evasion, "No, I don't know anyone I'd care to recommend to you." "That was all I wanted to ask you, Dr. Stadler," she said. "Thank you for giving me your time." He sat silently still for a moment, as if he could not bring himself to leave. "Miss Taggart," he asked, "could you show me the actual motor itself?" She looked at him astonished. "Why, yes, if you wish. But it's in an underground vault down in our terminal tunnels. I don't mind if you wouldn't mind taking me down there. I have no special motive, it's only my personal curiosity. I would like to see it, that's all." When they stood in the granite vault, over a glass case containing a shape of broken metal, he took off his hat with a slow, absent movement, and she could not tell whether it was the routine gesture of remembering that he was in a room with a lady, or the gesture of bearing one's head over a coffin. They stood in silence in the glare of a single light refracted from the glass surface to their faces. Train wheels were clicking in the distance, and it seemed at times as if a sudden, sharper jolt of vibration were about to awaken an answer from the corpse in the glass case. "It's so wonderful," said Dr. Stadler, his voice low. "It's so wonderful to see a great new crucial idea which is not mine." She looked at him, wishing she could believe that she understood him correctly. He spoke in passionate sincerity, discarding convention, discarding concern for whether it was proper to let her hear the confession of his pain, seeing nothing but the face of a woman who was able to understand. "Miss Taggart, do you know the hallmark of the second rater? It's resentment of another man's achievement. Those touchy mediocrities who sit trembling lest someone's work prove greater than their own, they have no inkling of the loneliness that comes when you reach the top, the loneliness for an equal, for a mind to respect, and an achievement to admire. They bare their teeth at you from out of their rat holes, thinking that you take pleasure in letting your brilliance dim them, while you'd give a year of your life to see a flicker of talent anywhere among them. They envy achievement, and their dream of greatness is a world where all men have become their acknowledged inferiors. They don't know that that dream is the infallible proof of mediocrity, because that sort of world is what the man of achievement would not be able to bear. They have no way of knowing what he feels when surrounded by inferiors. Hatred? No, not hatred, but boredom. The terrible, hopeless, draining, paralyzing boredom. On what account are praise and adulation from men whom you don't respect? Have you ever felt the longing for someone you could admire? For something not to look down at, but up to? I felt it all my life, she said. It was an answer she could not refuse him. I know, he said. And there was beauty in the impersonal gentleness of his voice. I knew it the first time I spoke to you. That was why I came today. He stopped for the briefest instant, but she did not answer the appeal, and he finished with the same quiet gentleness. Well, that was why I wanted to see the motor. I understand, she said softly. The tone of her voice was the only form of acknowledgement she could grant him. Miss Taggart, he said, his eyes lowered, looking at the glass case. I know a man who might be able to undertake the reconstruction of that motor. He would not work for me, so he is probably the kind of man you want. But by the time he raised his head, and before he saw the look of admiration in her eyes, the open look he had begged for, the look of forgiveness, he destroyed his single moment's atonement by adding in a voice of drawing-room sarcasm. Apparently the young man had no desire to work for the good of society or the welfare of science. He told me that he would not take a government job. I presume he wanted the bigger salary he could hope to obtain from a private employer. He turned away, not to see the look that was fading from her face, not to let himself know its meaning. Yes, she said, her voice hard. He is probably the kind of man I want. He's a young physicist from the Utah Institute of Technology, he said dryly. His name is Quentin Daniels. A friend of mine sent him to me a few months ago. He came to see me, but he would not take the job I offered. I wanted him on my staff. He had the mind of a scientist. I don't know whether he can succeed with your motor, but at least he has the ability to attempt it. I believe you can still reach him at the Utah Institute of Technology. I don't know what he's doing there now. They closed the institute a year ago. Thank you, Dr. Stadler. I shall get in touch with him. If you want me to, I'll be glad to help him with the theoretical part of it. I'm going to do some work myself, starting from the leads of that manuscript. I'd like to find the cardinal secret of energy that its author had found. It's his basic principle that we must discover. If we succeed, Mr. Daniels may finish the job as far as your motor is concerned. I will appreciate any help you may care to give me, Dr. Stadler. They walked silently through the dead tunnels of the terminal, down the ties of a rusted track under a string of blue lights, to the distant glow of the platforms. At the mouth of the tunnel they saw a man kneeling on the track, hammering at a switch, with the unrhythmical exasperation of uncertainty. Another man stood watching him impatiently. "Well, what's the matter with the damn thing?" asked the watcher. "Don't know. You've been at it for an hour." "Yeah. How long is it going to take?" "Who is John Galt?" Dr. Stadler winced. They had gone past the men when he said, "I don't like that expression." "I don't either," she answered. "Where did it come from?" "Nobody knows." They were silent. Then he said, "I knew a John Galt once, only he died long ago." "Who was he?" "I used to think that he was still alive, but now I'm certain that he must have died. He had such a mind that had he lived, the whole world would have been talking of him by now." "But the whole world is talking of him." He stopped still. "Yes," he said slowly, staring at a thought that had never struck him before. "Yes. Why? The word was heavy with the sound of terror. Who was he, Dr. Stadler? Why are they talking of him? Who was he? He shook his head with a shudder and said sharply, It's just a coincidence. The name is not uncommon at all. It's a meaningless coincidence. It has no connection with the man I knew. That man is dead. He did not permit himself to know the full meaning of the words he added. He has to be dead. The order that lay on his desk was marked confidential, emergency, priority, essential need certified by Office of Top Coordinator for the account of Project X, and demanded that he sell 10,000 tons of Reardon metal to the State Science Institute. Reardon read it and glanced up at the superintendent of his mills, who stood before him without moving. The superintendent had come in and put the order down on his desk without a word. I thought you'd want to see it, he said in answer to Reardon's glance. Reardon pressed a button summoning Miss Ives. He handed the order to her and said, Send this back to wherever it came from. Tell them that I will not sell any Reardon metal to the State Science Institute. Gwen Ives and the superintendent looked at him, at each other, and back at him again. What he saw in their eyes was congratulation. Yes, Mr. Reardon, Gwen Ives said formally, taking the slip as if it were any other kind of business paper. She bowed and left the room. The superintendent followed. Reardon smiled faintly, in greeting to what they felt. He felt nothing about that paper, or its possible consequences. By a sort of inner convulsion, which had been like tearing a plug out to cut off the current of his emotions, he had told himself 6 months ago, act first, keep the mills going, feel later. It had made him able to watch dispassionately the working of the fair share law. Nobody had known how that law was to be observed. First he had been told that he could not produce Reardon metal in an amount greater than the tonnage of the best special alloy other than steel produced by Oren Boyle. But Oren Boyle's best special alloy was some cracking mixture that no one cared to buy. Then he had been told that he could produce Reardon metal in the amount that Oren Boyle could have produced if he could have produced it. Nobody had known how this was to be determined. Somebody in Washington had announced a figure, naming a number of tons per year, giving no reasons. Everybody had let it go at that. He had not known how to give every consumer who demanded it an equal share of Reardon metal. The waiting list of orders could not be filled in 3 years, even had he been permitted to work at full capacity. New orders were coming in daily. They were not orders any longer in the old honorable sense of trade. They were demands. The law provided that he could be sued by any consumer who failed to receive his fair share of Reardon metal. Nobody had known how to determine what constituted a fair share of what amount. Then a bright young boy just out of college had been sent to him from Washington as deputy director of distribution. After many telephone conferences with the Capitol, the boy announced that customers would get 500 tons of the metal each in the order of the dates of their applications. Nobody had argued against his figure. There was no way to form an argument. The figure could have been 1 pound or 1,000,000 tons, with the same validity. The boy had established an office at the Reardon Mills, where 4 girls took applications for shares of Reardon metal. At the present rate of the mill's production, the applications extended well into the next century. 500 tons of Reardon metal could not provide 3 miles of rail for Taggart Transcontinental. It could not provide the bracing for one of Ken Daniger's coal mines. The largest industries, Reardon's best customers, were denied the use of his metal. But golf clubs made of Reardon metal were suddenly appearing on the market, as well as coffee pots, garden tools, and bathroom faucets. Ken Daniger, who had seen the value of the metal and had dared to order it against a fury of public opinion, was not permitted to obtain it. His order had been left unfilled, cut off without warning by the new laws. Mr. Moen, who had betrayed Taggart Transcontinental in its most dangerous hour, was now making switches of Reardon metal and selling them to the Atlantic Southern. Reardon looked on, his emotions plugged out. He turned away without a word when anybody mentioned to him what everybody knew, the quick fortunes that were being made on Reardon metal. Well, no, people said in drawing rooms, You mustn't call it black market, because it isn't really. Nobody is selling the metal illegally. They're just selling their right to it. Not selling, really. Just pooling their shares.
He did not want to know the insect intricacy of the deals through which the shares were sold and pooled, nor how a manufacturer in Virginia had produced in 2 months 5,000 tons of castings made of Reardon metal, nor what man in Washington was that manufacturer's unlisted partner. He knew that their profit on a ton of Reardon metal was 5 times larger than his own. He said nothing. Everybody had a right to the metal, except himself. The young boy from Washington, whom the steelworkers had nicknamed the Wet Nurse, hung around Reardon with a primitive, astonished curiosity, which incredibly was a form of admiration. Reardon watched him with disgusted amusement. The boy had no inkling of any concept of morality. It had been bred out of him by his college. This had left him an odd frankness, naive and cynical at once, like the innocence of a savage. "You despise me, Mr. Reardon," he had declared once, suddenly and without any resentment. "That's impractical." "Why is it impractical?" Reardon had asked. The boy had looked puzzled and had found no answer. He never had an answer to any why. He spoke in flat assertions. He would say about people, "He's old-fashioned. He's unreconstructed. He's unadjusted," without hesitation or explanation. He would also say, while being a graduate in metallurgy, "Iron smelting, I think, seems to require a high temperature." He uttered nothing but uncertain opinions about physical nature, and nothing but categorical imperatives about men. "Mr. Reardon," he had said once, "if you feel you'd like to hand out more of the metal to friends of yours, I mean in bigger halls, it could be arranged, you know. Why don't we apply for a special permission on the ground of essential need? I've got a few friends in Washington. Your friends are pretty important people, big businessmen. So it wouldn't be difficult to get away with the essential need dodge. Of course, there would be a few expenses for things in Washington. You know how it is. Things always occasion expenses."
"What things?"
"You understand what I mean?"
"No," Reardon had said. "I don't. Why don't you explain it to me?"
The boy had looked at him uncertainly, weighed it in his mind, then come out with, "It's bad psychology."
"What is?"
"You know, Mr. Reardon, it's not necessary to use such words as that."
"As what?"
"Words are relative. They're only symbols. If we don't use ugly symbols, we won't have any ugliness. Why do you want me to say things one way when I've already said them another?"
"Which way do I want you to say them?"
"Why do you want me to?"
"For the same reason that you don't."
The boy had remained silent for a moment, then had said, "You know, Mr. Reardon, there are no absolute standards. We can't go by rigid principles. We've got to be flexible. We've got to adjust to the reality of the day and act on the expediency of the moment."
"Run along, punk. Go and try to pour a ton of steel without rigid principles, on the expediency of the moment."
A strange sense, which was almost a sense of style, made Reardon feel contempt for the boy, but no resentment. The boy seemed to fit the spirit of the events around them. It was as if they were being carried back across a long span of centuries to the age where the boy had belonged, but he, Reardon, had not. Instead of building new furnaces, thought Reardon, he was now running a losing race to keep the old ones going. Instead of starting new ventures, new research, new experiments in the use of Reardon metal, he was spending the whole of his energy on a quest for sources of iron ore, like the men at the dawn of the Iron Age, he thought, but with less hope. He tried to avoid these thoughts. He had to stand on guard against his own feeling, as if some part of him had become a stranger that had to be kept numb, and his will had to be its constant, watchful anesthetic. That part was an unknown of which he knew only that he must never see its root and never give it voice. He had lived through one dangerous moment which he could not allow to return. It was the moment when, alone in his office on a winter evening, held paralyzed by a newspaper spread on his desk with a long column of directives on the front page, he had heard on the radio the news of Ellis Wyatt's flaming oil fields. Then, his first reaction, before any thought of the future,
any sense of disaster, any shock, terror, or protest, had been to burst out laughing. He had laughed in triumph, in deliverance, in a spurting, living exultation. And the words which he had not pronounced but felt were, "God bless you, Ellis, whatever you're doing." When he had grasped the implications of his laughter, he had known that he was now condemned to constant vigilance against himself. Like the survivor of a heart attack, he knew that he had had a warning, and that he carried within him a danger that could strike him at any moment. He had held it off since then. He had kept an even, cautious, severely controlled pace in his inner steps. But it had come close to him for a moment once again, when he had looked at the order of the State Science Institute on his desk. It had seemed to him that the glow moving over the paper did not come from the furnaces outside, but from the flames of a burning oil field. "Mr. Reardon," said the wet nurse, when he heard about the rejected order, "you shouldn't have done that."
"Why not? There's going to be trouble."
"What kind of trouble?"
"It's a government order. You can't reject a government order."
"Why can't I?"
"It's an essential need project. And secret, too. It's very important."
"What kind of a project is it?"
"I don't know. It's secret."
"Then how do you know it's important?"
"It said so."
"Who said so?"
"You can't doubt such a thing as that, Mr. Reardon."
"Why can't I?"
"But you can't."
"If I can't, then that would make it an absolute. And you said there aren't any absolutes."
"That's different."
"How is it different?"
"It's the government."
"You mean there aren't any absolutes except the government?"
"I mean, if they say it's important, then it is."
"Why?"
"I don't want you to get in trouble, Mr. Reardon. And you're going to, sure as hell. You ask too many whys. Now, why do you do that?"
Reardon glanced at him and chuckled. The boy noticed his own words and grinned sheepishly, but he looked unhappy. The man who came to see Reardon a week later was youngish and slenderish, but neither as young nor as slender as he tried to make himself appear. He wore civilian clothes and the leather leggings of a traffic cop. Reardon could not quite get it clear whether he came from the State Science Institute or from Washington. "I understand that you refuse to sell metal to the State Science Institute, Mr. Reardon," he said in a soft, confidential tone of voice.
"That's right," said Reardon.
"But wouldn't that constitute a willful disobedience of the law?"
"It's for you to interpret."
"May I ask your reason?"
"My reason is of no interest to you."
"Oh, but of course it is. We are not your enemies, Mr. Reardon. We want to be fair to you. You mustn't be afraid of the fact that you are a big industrialist. We won't hold it against you. We actually want to be as fair to you as to the lowest day laborer. We would like to know your reason."
"Print my refusal in the newspapers, and any reader will tell you my reason. It appeared in all the newspapers a little over a year ago."
"Oh, no, no, no. Why talk of newspapers? Can't we settle this as a friendly, private matter?"
"That's up to you."
"We don't want this in the newspapers."
"No."
"No.
We wouldn't want to hurt you."
Reardon glanced at him and asked, "Why does the State Science Institute need 10,000 tons of metal? What is Project X?"
"Oh, that is a very important project of scientific research, an undertaking of great social value that may prove of inestimable public benefit. But unfortunately, the regulations of top policy do not permit me to tell you its nature in fuller detail."
"You know," said Reardon, "I could tell you as my reason that I do not wish to sell my metal to those whose purpose is kept secret from me. I created that metal. It is my moral responsibility to know for what purpose I permit it to be used."
"Oh, but you don't have to worry about that, Mr. Reardon. We relieve you of the responsibility."
"Suppose I don't wish to be relieved of it."
But that is an old-fashioned and purely theoretical attitude."
"I said I could name it as my reason, but I won't. Because in this case I have another inclusive reason. I would not sell any Reardon metal to the State Science Institute for any purpose whatever, good or bad, secret or open."
"But why?"
"Listen," said Reardon slowly. "There might be some sort of justification for the savage societies in which a man had to expect that enemies could murder him at any moment and had to defend himself as best he could. but there can be no justification for a society in which a man is expected to manufacture the weapons for his own murderers.
I don't think it's advisable to use such words, Mr. Reardon. I don't think it's practical to think in such terms. After all, the government cannot, in the pursuit of wide national policies, take cognizance of your personal grudge against some one particular institution.
Then don't take cognizance of it.
What do you mean?